This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, the 21st of May, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear from the Capitol, where the Senate's begun considering the comprehensive immigration reform package. We'll go to Lebanon, where at least 70 people have been killed in some of the worst fighting since the end of the country's civil war. And it's been 9 years since Indonesian President Suharto fell from power, but he has still to be brought to justice. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. An outspoken member of Afghanistan's parliament has been suspended until the end of her term in office. The lower house of parliament voted today to remove Malalai Joya from her position for her televised comments, saying that Afghanistan's legislature is worse than a stable full of animals. Because in a stable, at least, quote, you have cows which provide milk and you've got donkeys which can carry loads. A video of her comments was played 3 times before the vote to suspend her until 2010. Malalai Joya has been described as the most famous woman in Afghanistan. She has been critical of former warlords within the country's Loya Jirga, who were allegedly responsible for widespread human rights abuses during the country's civil war. An ongoing Israeli military campaign in the Gaza Strip is now in its 5th day. In the meantime, the 2 main Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, have once again agreed to stop infighting. Rami Amagiri has more from Gaza.
Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip that started on Thursday have thus far killed 36 Palestinians, the majority of whom are members of the Islamic Jihad, the armed wing of Hamas. An Israeli missile hit a group of civilians yesterday gathered near the house of Hamas senior political leader and MP in Gaza City, Khalil Al-Hayya. The attack killed 9 people, including 7 relatives of Al-Hayya. Israeli cabinet members today hinted at the possibility of assassinating top Hamas leaders in a bid to stop the firing of homemade shells into Israeli border towns. The airstrikes on Gaza came shortly after Hamas and Fatah agreed to end 1 week of infighting that killed 55 people. Walid al-Mudallal is a Gaza political analyst.
Most of the previous agreements and conciliations have not addressed the most contentious issues, and this has been the reason for renewals of clashes from time to time.
A recent opinion poll by the Al-Najah University in the West Bank indicates widespread pessimism over the sustainability of that ceasefire, said to be the 15th in recent months. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
A delegation of Mexico's Zapatista rebels closed a 3-month-long support camp for the Cucupa indigenous peoples of Baja California, where national and international observers, including solidarity groups from the United States, accompanied the community during this year's fishing season. Luz Ruiz reports.
A delegation of commanders from the Zapatista National Liberation Army, or EZLN, and Subcomandante Marcos officially closed the Cucapá camp in the community of El Mayor in Baja California over the weekend. This camp was set up to accompany the region's indigenous peoples, the Cucapás, during the 2007 fishing season, as the community has been pressured by the state to abandon its traditional fishing practices. The Cucapá claimed that the state has systematically withheld permits from them while authorizing entry to transnational fishing industry. The Cucapá and Zapatista delegation visits to other regions in Mexico are part of the second stage of the Zapatista initiative known as the Other Campaign. The initiative seeks to bring together diverse sectors of Mexican grassroots social movements in a broad popular front against neoliberal economic policies and social injustice. The next major event for the Other Campaign is a continental encounter of indigenous peoples of the Americas to be held in Sonora, Mexico later this year. From the Tijuana-San Diego border, this is Luz Ruiz for Free Speech Radio News.
Tens of thousands demonstrated in Caracas on Saturday against the Venezuelan government's decision to not renew the broadcast license of RCTV, the country's oldest television network, Greg Wilbert reports.
With the broadcast license of the opposition-oriented RCTV set to expire on May 27th, demonstrators marched through the Venezuelan capital of Caracas on Saturday to voice their opposition to the government's decision not to renew the network's license for broadcast over the airwaves. President Chavez justifies the decision by saying that RCTV supported the 2002 coup attempt and continuously violates broadcast regulations. RCTV says the refusal to renew their license is due to its opposition-oriented editorial line. Recent polls indicate that while a majority of Venezuelans continue to support Chavez, the decision to take RCTV off the air is quite unpopular. RCTV can, however, still broadcast over cable and satellite after May 27th. The Chavez government announced last week that a new public television station would replace RCTV, which, according to the government, will represent a far broader spectrum of views than RCTV ever did. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The Senate began considering the comprehensive immigration reform package today. Since its introduction late last week, the proposals received criticism from both the left and the right. FSRN's Yang Meisher has more from Washington, D.C.
The immigration reform package emerged after weeks of intense negotiation between both parties and Bush administration officials. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has been a driving force behind this bipartisan compromise. He says the proposal would enhance the U.S. immigration system in many aspects.
The bill will give us a chance to strengthen border security, put in place an effective and efficient employer verification system, design a new worker program to take pressure off the borders, and give those 12 million undocumented immigrants the opportunity to come out of the shadows into the light of America.
Reid introduced the bill on the Senate floor, and it came under immediate attack. The proposal would offer quick legal status to the nation's 12 million undocumented workers and allow them to apply for American citizenship after they pay fines and follow a stringent procedure. Kentucky Republican Senator Jim Bunning says undocumented workers who broke the law don't deserve legal status.
I just wonder what message does rewarding those who willfully break the law send to our nation's young people? What message does it send to the rest of the world? Doesn't it make everyone who's trying to play by the rules seem foolish?
The immigration reform proposal also sets a temporary worker program. Low-skilled workers would be allowed to work in the United States for 3 stints of 2 years each. In between those sessions, they have to return to their homeland and stay for at least 1 year. Senator Reid admits the temporary worker provision is flawed.
We must not create a law that guarantees a permanent underclass. People who are here to work in low-wage, low-skilled jobs, but do not have the chance to put down roots or benefit from the opportunities that American citizenship affords.
Reid said the proposal is just the first step towards the comprehensive immigration reform. He urges senators to finish debating and vote on the bill this week. But opponents of the bill say it's impossible to pass such an important and controversial package in such a short time. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
Monday marked the second day of fighting near the northern city of Tripoli between Lebanese security forces and the group known as Fatah al-Islam, a Sunni Muslim group that emerged in November of last year in Lebanon. More than 70 people have been killed, including at least 27 soldiers and 15 civilians. It's the worst internal fighting in Lebanon since the 1975 to 1990 civil war, which claimed more than 250,000 lives. Adding to the violence, a large car bomb exploded last night in the Christian neighborhood of Acharafia in East Beirut, killing 2 and wounding 10. Meanwhile, as fighting rages in northern Lebanon, observers say that around 40,000 Palestinians living in the Nahr el-Bared refugee camp are caught in the crossfire between Fatah al-Islam and government forces. Jackson Ellers and Simba Russo report from Lebanon.
The mostly pro-government crowd gathered at last night's blast site in East Beirut were quick to blame Syria for the fighting in the north and for the bomb blast in Acharafia. They say both incidents are an attempt to create instability in order to block a United Nations investigation into the 2005 assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Top-ranking Syrian officials are named as potential agents in the plot. Wael is a university student who was walking nearby when the bomb went off.
There is a link because Fatah al-Islam, they are related to Syria. Syria is supporting them. And then these regions here and the Christians in Lebanon, especially Ashrafiyya, are against Syria. Because of this, they are bombing this region here. Fatah al-Islam organization are not Palestinians. I don't think Palestinians have any relation with this bomb.
The major Palestinian organizations operating in the Lebanese camps, like the PLO and the main branch of Fatah, had disavowed Fatah al-Islam and any group that would destabilize relations between Palestinians and the Lebanese government. Local analysts say that it is no secret that Sunni Islamist groups like Fatah al-Islam have been operating in Lebanon, in Palestinian camps, and in cities like Tripoli. Rania Masri is a political commentator and professor at Balamon University near Tripoli.
We do have, at the very least, clear evidence that Bandar al-Sultan, the Saudi prince, was funding Fatah al-Islam. We have other evidence that the Hariris were funding Fatah al-Islam, as well as Jind al-Sham. We also have to ask, how representative are they within the camps?
Seymour Hirsch also alleged in a March article in the New Yorker magazine that the current pro-Western government, and specifically Saad Hariri, the son of slain Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, actually funneled arms to a similar Sunni fundamentalist group, the Jund al-Sham. Analysts suggest this support was intended to pit these Sunni groups against Hezbollah, the Shia group that heads the government opposition and maintains a huge arsenal, as seen during its defense of Lebanon against Israel in last summer's devastating war. Whatever the case, UN Security Council Resolution 1559 calls on all armed groups in Lebanon to disarm. Professor Rania Masri of Balamon University worries the latest round of violence might lead to a larger policy of disarming only those groups the government deems dangerous. Still, she says there are larger questions to answer about the plight of Palestinians living in Lebanon.
Regardless who's funding these organizations, regardless who's funding these individuals, they are born out of the camps. And if they are born out of the camps, there has to be a situation in the camps that makes it possible for them to at least exist there. And what we see happening for the Palestinians in Lebanon since 1948 is that the Palestinians have been stripped of almost all their civil and human rights.
Observers point to the dire conditions in the Palestinian camps as being perfect recruiting grounds for Al-Qaeda-style organizations. Most Palestinian camps in Lebanon lack even basic infrastructure, and Palestinians have very little legal means to make money. Meanwhile, the fighting rages on in northern Lebanon. In and around the Palestinian refugee camp of Nahr el-Bared, there are nearly 40,000 Palestinians trapped inside the camp that are worried that neither side will back down. Despite a two-hour ceasefire today that allowed the Red Cross to evacuate some of the wounded, camp residents like Ashraf Abu Khorj made appeals to both sides to allow the children of the camp to leave. Abu Khorj spoke to FSRN late this afternoon from the refugee camp.
We are helpless. We can do nothing. Where I am standing now is not very safe. But I have to be outside to get the signal for the phone so I can talk. I am risking my life for the phone so that I can continue to communicate with people outside the camp. I hope that someone will hear our appeal. Those politicians, those who gave the green light. On what basis did they give the green light? Yes, okay, we are all with the army, but on what basis?
A Fatah al-Islam spokesperson told Associated Press today that if the Lebanese army didn't stop their assault, they would begin attacking targets outside of Tripoli, sparking fears of a larger sectarian conflict in Lebanon. Ceasefire efforts have failed to hold thus far. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers with Simba Rousseau.
Infant mortality rates in the United States are among the highest of all developed countries. But if you live in a minority community, the chances of your child dying before the age of one are more than double the national average. Today, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services kicked off a campaign to address and reduce infant mortality rates among babies in the African American community. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
The Department of Health and Human Services estimates the infant mortality rate in the United States is now comparable to Croatia, Lithuania, and Taiwan. Mortality rates in the U.S. are defined by the number of deaths by the age of one per thousand live births. Over the last couple of years, the infant mortality rate for the general population has held steady with seven infant deaths per 1,000 live births. For African-American babies, however, that number is 13 deaths, which is more than twice the national rate. The new U.S. Department of Health campaign will bring attention to the high infant mortality rates among African-American babies. Garth Graham is a Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health with the Department of Health and Human Services.
The issues with infant mortality are reflective a lot on the issues we're dealing with our healthcare system overall. So we know that we could do better as a country when it comes to healthcare. In particular, and that's overall when we're talking about the general population. What we've seen over the past two or three decades or so is a persistence in the elevated rate of infant mortality, particularly in the African-American community. So what does that mean? Well, it means in a generic way that black babies actually die at twice the rate of that in the general population. And it's been that way now for a couple of years.
Let's face it. Caring and planning for your baby begins long before you see his precious little face.
The initiative, which was kicked off today with the health fair and press conference, will include print and radio PSAs.
All a part of the plan for a healthy baby. Step up and learn what you can do today to ensure your baby's health tomorrow. Call 1-800-444-6477.
Tanya Lewis Lee is an author, producer, and wife of filmmaker Spike Lee. She's a spokesperson for the campaign and says the high infant mortality rate cuts across all economic lines in the African-American community. She also says that African-American women need to be aware of the pitfalls in order to protect their babies.
African-American women are under tremendous amounts of stress. Stress has a high impact on infant mortality, as well as just general health care. And I think that those issues really do affect the African-American community in a whole more often than the general community, and certainly it affects the infant mortality rate as well.
Blanca Calbirth is pregnant with her first child. She came to the campaign kickoff today and says it's important to spread the word on infant mortality in the black community.
Now that we know, there's really something that we need to do as African-American women, and to try and get the information out as much as possible, that we look out for one another as well as ourselves. I probably would have never known if I didn't come out today about the infant mortality rate and how high it was. And as far as with our males, we need to get them out and involved as well.
The campaign will take place in African-American communities all across the U.S. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
It's been 9 years since the fall of Indonesian President Suharto. His ascent to power in 1965 was announced by the brutal murder of between 300,000 and 1 million of his opponents, many of them left-wing activists who were labeled as communists on lists provided by the CIA. Suharto is accused of astounding corruption and gross human rights abuses during his 32 years in power. But as Rebecca Henschke reports from Jakarta, any attempts to bring him to trial have failed.
Hundreds of student and human rights activists marched through the streets of Jakarta to commemorate the fall of the Suharto dictatorship. Similar demonstrations are taking place across Indonesia. These protesters are demanding that Suharto and his closest associates face justice for the corruption and human rights abuses carried out during his 32-year dictatorship. They shout that the current president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, is weak as he's been unable to bring Suharto to court. Professor George Eunice Adedondro, who was deeply involved in the anti-Suharto student movement, says today's leaders are uninterested in prosecuting Suharto.
All the regimes that have replaced Suharto know that they will never have the same power as he did. So they are all trying to speed things up. They try to accumulate wealth through corruption as well. So why bother with Suharto if we are doing the same thing?
Suharto, now 85 years old, has successfully avoided court by claiming he's too ill to stand trial. Historians and human rights activists accuse him of being responsible for the deaths of over 800,000 people in both Indonesia and East Timor. He's also accused of accumulating a personal fortune of $16 billion, a figure that does not take into account corrupt profits made by his family and its cronies. Despite this record, Suharto was embraced by Western powers, particularly the United States. He was anti-communist and admired by politicians in the West for bringing so-called stability to the region. Tedje Baya spent much of his youth imprisoned by the Suharto regime. He says those that dared to speak against Suharto were punished.
Some of my friends, many of my friends, was abruptly arrested, tortured, if they dare to do that. So many lists of his crime. The mass killing is more than 500,000. On 1965-66, the Tanjung Priok killing and also the Lampung killing, and of course our friends from Aceh and Timor Leste.
He says human rights abuses by the country's military elite continue to take place in Indonesia, particularly in the province of Papua. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rebecca Henschke of Radio 68H in Jakarta.
Algeria held its third multi-party elections Friday, 5 weeks after the explosion of two bombs in the Algerian capital claimed by Al-Qaeda in North Africa. The National Liberation Front lost 60 seats in parliamentary elections but kept its leading position. But the elections didn't guarantee transparency at the ballot. Khaled Sid Mohand reports from Algiers.
Algerians voted last week to renew the parliament for the third time since 1992's military coup. The coup followed the first round of the only free elections held in the Algerian history. Those elections were won hands down by the Islamic Front of Salvation, a party that has been outlawed since then. The following polls were characterized by massive fraud. So why would Algerians participate in elections with such risks of irregularity? Hamidou Nossi is the candidate of the Liberal Gathering for Culture and Democracy Party.
Il n'y a pas d'autre alternative.
There is no alternative. Despite the risk of fraud, we believe that there aren't any other solutions. We're running these elections in order to enlarge the political breach for the next generation. By dint of our work inside the institution, maybe someday these political maneuvers will remain in our memory only as bad souvenirs. Otherwise, we got the revolutionary way, which is not the credo of our party. This is not our choice. We refuse to use violence.
The 200,000 victims left by the 1990s civil war and the 1992 coup remain fresh in the memory of the Algerian people. That is likely why the use of violence to oppose the regime is not an option for most Algerians. But what has taken the place of the wrath of the end of the 1980s is disenchantment. By the end of the afternoon, while everybody should normally pay attention to the early results of the ballot, Algerians were instead following the Arab Soccer Champions League, which saw the victory of the Algerian team over the Jordanian one. 44-year-old taxi driver Said Hamdan, while following the soccer match, and explained why he paid less attention to the Algerian campaign than to the French presidential elections.
We don't have any real politicians here. They're traffickers. They only work for their own interests and benefits. This is why I don't feel concerned. I did pay more attention to the French presidential elections. It was excellent, exciting, simple, clear, with real debates. I saw the debate between the two main candidates. It was a real debate. It's the real democracy, and that's what we wish for in our country.
According to official figures released by the Ministry of Interior, over 65% of the people didn't show up at the polling stations, which constitutes the lowest rate of participation of the young Algerian history. But many think that the real figure would rather be around 70%. Dalila Talab is a 39-year-old member of the oldest opponent party, the Front of the Socialist Forces, who called for the boycott of the elections. A former deputy at the parliament, she explains why her party chose not to participate to the elections.
I think the fraud in this country has been raised to an art. I'll never forget, while I was deputy, this commission of inquiry about the fraud observed at the 1997 local elections. The report stated that the regime used 60 different techniques of fraud. This report has disappeared until now. So the fraud is not something new. On the other hand, the lack of prerogatives of the parliament is something we saw and experienced during our participation at the parliament in 1997. And we couldn't even enjoy the parliamentary immunity, as we have been beaten many times. But the worst is that the little freedom of speech we could enjoy at that time to express our claims is now over. So we no longer expect anything from this institution.
If the ballot didn't really convince the Algerian people that it could change their difficult life conditions, despite the fact that the regime has amassed $80 billion in foreign exchange, it seems that the international community observed these elections as a real democratic thing. Most journalists and observers talked more about the poor rate of participation than the real role of the parliament. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Khaled Sid Mohand in Algiers.
New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's plans to improve the city's environmental quality were met with no opposition, but little in the way of concrete support by the New York legislature last week. Bloomberg's plan includes taxes on driving in the city, similar to those used to cut down on traffic in London. Such proposals have been met with relative approval by New Yorkers, but also criticized as vague and unlikely to achieve substantial change. But one local artist is demonstrating that the city's geography may change in the coming decades as well, and could include drastic changes to the way New Yorkers live. FSRN's David Enders files this report.
On the Atlantic Ocean in Brooklyn's Canarsie neighborhood, a 10-foot rise in sea levels would mean Scott Roseberry's home across the street from the water would flood.
I live in the condominium at the end, Seaview Estates. Will the basin flood out the condominium? Wow.
Yeah. This line is showing people, well, this is what they're saying, that by 2080, which may not be in our lifetime, but certainly could be in her lifetime.
Roseberry and his daughter stopped to talk with artist Eve Mosher on Sunday as Mosher drew a chalk line marking the future high water mark down Seaview Avenue.
And I'm doing it in chalk because it's not permanent, because it's something that if we act now, if we do stuff today,
right,
then we can change that future, which is really empowering.
So this area will be flooded out by, what, the Jamaica Bay?
Yeah, by the basin and the bay, yeah.
Mosher is using one of those machines that's used to draw lines on a baseball field or football pitch. The varying thickness of the line attests that it's tougher than it looks. Mosher is also handing out information about sustainable living in blank postcards addressed to the mayor and governor. She encourages people to let the government know they are concerned about climate change.
This is my first really, certainly my first 70-mile art project. I've done outdoor sculptures that were, about the environment, but nothing of the scale, nothing that really was involving the community to the extent that this is, which was really... really the important part of this project was to get out and talk to people about climate change and people who may not know anything about climate change, who may not understand how it's going to affect them personally. This was a really important thing to have an opportunity to do that. And I think I've already proven it in only 3 days and I've had a really diverse audience I've talked to. It's been really great.
Mosher says that the line, while based on a topographical map, represents an artist's rendering. But Keith Dixon, a meteorologist at the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in New Jersey, says such a rise is possible during storms, and that even if steps are taken to lower emissions in the coming years, sea levels are likely going to rise anyway.
One thing to consider is that the ocean is fairly slow to respond. Right now it's out of balance. It hasn't adjusted to the warming that has already occurred. So even if we do the hypothetical example of what if we were able to cut emissions to a very low level, just slightly above zero, not something that is really expected, but if that were to happen, if we were to hold greenhouse gas levels constant to what they are today for the next 100 years, you would still see sea level rise several inches because the ocean is still taking up heat. It's still coming into balance with the changes that have already occurred. But certainly the amount of increase that's put on top of that depends upon the emission scenario that we follow.
Mosher will continue chalking the line until mid-October. As she walks, she'll travel across seaside neighborhoods slated for hundreds of millions of dollars in real estate development in the next 5 years. I'm David Enders in New York for FSRN.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.